once again for Truth About Markets in London, the original Truth About Markets show. We now have Truth About Markets New Zealand, Truth About Markets USA on GCN Network in the United States of America. And I might also add that on Truth About Markets USA on GCN, you know, we get 2 minutes per hour to put ads in there. And I put out a message on maxkaiser.com for anyone who's got a project on piratemyfilm.com to send me an ad, and I can play it on my Truth About Markets show USA on GCN. And we got an ad, or it's coming this week, from a project called The Trillionaires on Pirate My Film. And we'll be playing that ad this week on our show. If you want us to play an ad that you created on our GCN show, it's got to be 30 seconds long. And it has to be an ad for maxkaiser.com or for this show, Truth About Markets, in London on Residence 104.4. All you residence people, here's a way to get free advertising. That's right. Send us an ad. We'll play it over there.
Hey, Max, that sounds like a good idea. Can I submit an ad?
Sure you can. Sure you can.
You know, I wanted to say, you know, outside of any policies, fiscal, monetary, government, whatever, budget policy.
Yeah?
It is nice to see that the UK now has a prime minister who is not a poodle.
Yeah, wow, who would have thought?
First we had, like, this, you know, high on religion Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Yeah.
Running around in some sort of rapture.
Yeah.
And then we had that depressed guy. What was his name? Oh, yeah.
Brown.
Yeah, Gordon Brown. He's disappeared.
Totally.
I think he has a bottle of whiskey somewhere up in Fife. And,
yeah.
Or Kirkcaldy.
He's doing it, yeah.
And but now we have some guy there who's, you know, standing up to everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we haven't said anything bad about David Cameron on this show since he took office, except for one show. I think maybe I lapsed into some Cameron hating, Cameron bashing. But it's been tough to really hate this guy, you know.
I'm sure we'll have reason to very soon. But right now,
I guess so, you know. But, like, remember the expectation that Barack Obama was going to be something, a breath of fresh air, a change, a game changer.
Yeah, he was going to stop the torture, get rid of this intelligence industrial complex, restore some of the Constitution. And everybody was hoping, because he's a constitutional scholar.
Yeah.
That he would restore it.
Right. And then he came into office and he turned out to be worse than Bush. He's increased the war. He's given huge bailouts to Wall Street and the health industry through the so-called health reform and financial regulation reform. And the guy is just a complete... Anyway, so the expectations were shattered. Whereas Cameron, of course, expectations were that he'd be like Margaret Thatcher-esque, Tory tough, whatever. And, you know, I mean, like, what did he say last week when he said that Israel has got to stop running a prison camp?
That's right.
In Palestine?
Yeah.
I mean, those are bold words from somebody running Britain, which is one of the strongholds of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, that they have tremendous influence over there.
Yeah, he's been standing up. And by the way, he stood side by side with the Turkish prime minister, which is being very much demonized now in the U.S. It was remarkable how fast Turkey has become this enemy, this arch enemy now. And there's lots of talk of all sorts of nasty things about Turkey now in the U.S. press.
Yeah, well, we figured that. We sussed that one out, didn't we? Because it has to do with the water. They need the water to go into Iraq because of the oil, and it flows through the Euphrates River, which means Turkey. So we have to vilify Turkey to get access to the water. Or all that colonization of Iraq would be for naught.
That's true. And you see, though, the whole evolution of how they were basically forcing Turkey out. And I'm pretty sure it had to do with the water, but the genesis of it, of course, is that prior to the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. did everything in its power, along with AIPAC and the ADL and groups like that, to deny that there was a genocide in Armenia, which there clearly was. But the demonization, the whole conflict with Turkey started when Congress actually then decided to announce formally that there was a genocide in Armenia, which Turkey didn't like. And I think that's part of the reason why they have become more independent, which of course is the biggest sin in empire, anybody who is independent or tried to stand up to empire always gets destroyed in any empire.
Yeah, you know, Israel doesn't want you to use the H word. You know, that's the word that they get to use only for them.
Like H2O?
It's like the black community in America.
Oh, yeah.
Can't use the N word. N word. Only we can use that in our rap songs. Whitey can't use that word. No way, honky. You can't use the N word. So in discussing genocides and other such political atrocities, you can't use the H word, because only the H word applies to the H of the 20th century. Yeah, that's our word.
Well, speaking of co-opting words, so here's a story we've been covering on MaxKaiser.com, and that's all these the fires. You know, in Russia, the temperatures have been now over 40 degrees Celsius, which to the many Americans watching this, that's 104 degrees Fahrenheit,
Yowza!
Which is a 10% increase over the previous record high, which happened in the 1920s. So, you know, if you look at any chart, as if you look at bull markets or look at any sort of where the trend is going, reaching higher highs is a sign that the trend is up.
Right? It's an ecological H word.
Well, so I was looking at this, you know, the forest, all sorts of fires and the peat fires, and there's just, you know, homes being devastated, smoke clouds over Moscow, so lots of, you know, pollution there, caused by the fire.
Pollution is terrible.
But I was suddenly remembering this morning that, wasn't it, I remember recently that it was, Russia was celebrating global warming, the thought that there's going to be global warming, because they said it's good for us because, you know, we have a cold climate. And Putin in 2003, September 2003, said that, signaled his approval for global warming, noting that global warming would help Russians, quote, save on fur coats and other warm things.
Boy, now, was he wrong!
They also, of course, were hoping that, well, they're happy with the Arctic ice cap melting, because then it makes it easier for them to drill for minerals and oil and gas and stuff like that. But here's a quote from 2009 to the BBC, Renat Gizatulin, a spokesman for the Natural Resources Ministry in Russia. He said, quote, "We are not panicking. Global warming is not as catastrophic for us as it might be for other countries. If anything, we'll be even better off. As the climate warms, more of Russia's territory will be freed up for agriculture and industry." Now, just to, just to note that 32% of the agricultural lands this summer, because of this heat, have been destroyed. So the crop output is down over 17% just for the wheat crop. And as a result, wheat prices globally have hit a 14-month high. Somebody in our comment section actually noted that apparently it's the sharpest jump in wheat prices since 1973. I don't know if that's correct. I haven't checked that information, but somebody did note that.
Yes, well, this is really, of course, interesting, because people who talk about climate change and global warming, they tend to view things through a perspective that is dominated by 300 years of mankind's success in taming nature, discovering subatomic particles, discovering things like string theory, by exploring outer space, by exploring parallel universes, by exploring other galaxies. So humans have really developed an overdeveloped sense of their ability to understand and master nature. Truth is that the forces that glue nature together are beyond the comprehension of any mortal on planet Earth. And therefore, occasionally, as is now, when the forces that glue nature together start to change dramatically, humans, like species before them, could be the dinosaurs, for example, get caught in the crosshairs and risk extinction. And I think that's what we're talking about now. Extinction. Human extinction. So I think the debate of global warming, climate change is over. We're talking now about the countdown to human extinction due to man-made, anthropomorphic, climate change, global warming, and it's an ecological H word, you all, encompassing now close to 7 billion walking, talking anthro units, previously called humans.
There's been many charges on the site that somehow, by noting the existence of, say, the heat wave in Russia, the record temperatures, that the leap is then made that we're for redistribution of wealth.
Well, let me just point out a couple of things. First of all, you know, the catastrophic forces of nature, and this is an instance now, this is unlike any previous instance, because this catastrophe was perpetrated by a species, that is to say, humans. Now, if you go back to the dinosaurs, they did not create the meteor that slammed into Earth that made them extinct. Here, you've got humans, through their own activity, like ants in an ant farm, fouling the ant farm until they all die. You've got humans fouling their own environment and triggering catastrophic eco-holocaust due to their own actions, okay? So let's be clear about that. This is not a once-in-a-millennium ecological phenomenon that we had nothing to do with. That's not the case. This is man-made, triggered by human industrial activity, catastrophic premature extinction brought on through mass suicide. It's like the guy from the Hale-Bopp comet was running the world and got everyone to drink the cyanide, which in fact is exactly what's happened. Dick Cheney, Halliburton, Exxon, various oil companies and energy companies around the world have sold the human population on the need to kill themselves, and the result is extinction. And that's the timeline to extinction is right now.
Well, I'm not so sure if there's going to be total human extinction because, you know, who knows? I'm sure, however, there's a supply and demand situation and, you know, that will regulate. I think that's going to be the thing that regulates. I'm not sure there's any sort of human intervention that could alter the course. I'm sure, A, that's too late, and B, you know, the most powerful humans always try to favor themselves.
Well, getting back to the comments made by Russia back in the 2003 period, it's just, I think that's part of, remember back in 2003, we were still in the grips of a 25-year bull market, and people had the sense of they can get rich and they are the masters of the universe. And since that time, both the ecology and the economy have collapsed. They're collapsing for the same reason, liquidity evaporation in both the atmosphere and the Wall Street securities markets, and various global markets. And so the hubris of those early 00 years of saying that, well, global warming is a good thing, it's literally, you know, the Pandora's box. And you got to go back to the Greek myths and legends to really understand the true forces at play here. The hubris and, you know, Icarus flying to the sun with his wax wings, falling to Earth, or Prometheus giving fire to the mortals and incurring the wrath of the gods. And all of these things are not just from random imagination musings of a few Greeks drunk on wine. They come from the deep, hard-coded mandala of myths and images, as talked about by such greats as Joseph Campbell.
You got me excited there talking about the Greek gods, because I think I'm going to...
You live with one.
Oh, my God. No, I think I'm going to try to establish this as a religion, reestablish it as a religion. Because I think, you know, getting into the organized religion racket is a good one. I think you're very protected by powerful armies, and you get all sorts of constitutional rights that have been removed from most other people. But I think the Greek gods, I think that's cool. I think people will flock to my church.
Oh, I've been flocking to your church for a while now.
Yeah, but I need to spread it. I need to tell people.
Yeah, spread it, baby.
I need to tell people about Zeus and all these. I got to read up on my gods. But, you know, I also like, you know, it's more, you know, it's like replacing the Cold War Olympics.
Speaking of sexual tension, I noticed that more and more commenters on our YouTube editions of our TV shows seem to be concluding that you and I have a relationship beyond merely professional.
These people make me laugh. People make me laugh. I do like reading comments. They're funny. But Max.
Yeah, what's up? What's up,
speaking
baby?
Speaking of gods and delusions and stuff like that. Did you see this piece on Carl Denninger's market ticker?
Not yet. I saw the headline, though. Carl Denninger, gotta love him.
Gotta love him. Good God, revisions to chart. Ponzi, Ponzi, Ponzi. Yes, the U.S. came out with their GDP numbers, revised GDP numbers.
Yes, yes.
And the gap between the stated GDP numbers by the U.S. government and the real GDP numbers as by the real facts are so huge. And you've got to go. Actually, come to maxkaiser.com, and there's a link to it. It's easier than saying market-ticker.org. But, so his revised charts, and he's good at making these charts.
Oh,
is that in 2009, there was actually negative just nearly 14% GDP in the U.S., but the depth... The worst that the U.S. ever officially reported was negative 2%, and just briefly.
Right.
But he's saying that it was actually negative 14% according to these charts, and it's still negative almost 8%, whereas officially they're saying it's almost positive 4%. So this huge gap between the reality and, well, the lie, it's not even perception. Nobody believes it other than, well, I guess it is amplified a bit by the mainstream media, who all say, you know, the U.S. economy is doing better than Europe, and the mighty American economy is recovering again. GDP is up almost 4%.
Mm-hmm. Well, I covered this on a recent Huffington Post post, which is called something something masking deflation.
The hologram.
Oh, a hologram, price hologram masking deflation. So the prices that are used to calculate GDP, the GDP number that's issued and published by the government, are based on prices that are manufactured using price manufacturing algorithms on Wall Street. And as I explained, it's not the prices that you find on stocks, for example, on the New York Stock Exchange, are not prices that are the result of buyers and sellers seeking each other out and making transactions. No. The computer picks a price first, and then the computer fills in all the volume of buys and sells because the computer has huge buying and selling accounts. 70% of all the volume are these accounts that are computers trading with each other, and they create the volume to get to the price. So the price is picked first, and they fill the volume in second. It used to be the opposite. The price discovery, as it's called, would be the volume first, and then based on the volume, you end up with the price. Now you have the price first, and they fill in the volume secondarily. So that's the hologram of prices. Prices are manufactured through algorithmic trading, through digital phantasmagorical painting of the tape, as we used to call it back in the day. And now you've got the GDP numbers coming out based on these painted numbers, based on the hologram of prices. But the underlying truth is that you've got massive catastrophic deflation. Wages are collapsing. Prices are collapsing. And people always say, wait, how can you call it deflation when, you know, the price of my Twinkies went up by 25 cents, or The price for my car insurance went up 10%. The reason I can call it deflation is twofold. Number one, your net experience in the economy is negative if you take into consideration the fact that your house is down sharply and about to get cut in value again by at least 50%. So you have to add that in. You give a whole picture. Number two, when was the last time you had an increase in your wages? Inflation or increase in money supply means lots of money chasing fewer goods, and your value as a worker would also, as reflected in wages, be inflating, would go up. But wages are going down. Employment is going down because there's a deflationary collapse. Now, along the way, some prices may go up, but those are prices that are going up because of the deflationary effect of reducing competition. When competition leaves the marketplace, when the economy is collapsing and you go from having 20, let's say, people offering insurance to two, the two remaining, the duopoly, can raise prices. That's a lack of competition. That's oligarchy monopoly pricing. That's not inflation. Don't confuse that with inflation. So the trend is deflation. And the trend is price collapse. And I see on piratemyfilm.com that Stacey Herbert just made a comment on her film, Inflationist versus Deflationist, which I'm very anxious to read as soon as I get off this show.
Well, you know, you're talking about deflation and you're talking about the house prices and stuff like that. I'll put a link to this other story I've been reading that I found via nakedcapitalism.com, and it's regarding the global housing bubble. The aftermath of the global housing bubble chokes the world banking system. Only a coordinated loan massacre could defeat a Japanese-style dead and dying of debt kamikaze. Hell approaches us all, but only for an extended period. So, again, some great charts here. You've got to see them. It's very difficult to explain them all in detail, but I'll make a little attempt. The one chart shows real house prices 1997 to 2008 and shows that the U.S., by comparison to much of Europe, had just a tiny housing bubble. The two biggest housing bubbles, according to all of the data, was Ireland, but now Ireland is just in a dead heat with the U.K. in terms of house prices, of how much of a bubble it is. And the U.K. house bubble dwarfs by 100% the U.S. housing bubble, even at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
The other giants of housing bubbles are Spain, followed by Sweden, France, Norway, and Denmark. The only two that have still had deflation over that entire period, Japan and Germany, the two export powerhouses, of course.
Mm.
By the way, I would have to say that the house prices in Germany might have been deflating for the past 10 years, but I believe those Germans are very much involved in like the house price bubble in Spain, for example. A lot of Germans have been not buying homes in Germany where they rent, but buying them down in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
They have a chart here, deleveraging is a myth. And that is, they show the residential property values. This is just for the U.S., and as you can see, Max, if you look at this, it's just a total collapse.
Really?
Mm. However, the mortgage debts have not gone away. Property has fallen in the U.S. from $20 trillion to $13 trillion.
Ouch.
That's a massive collapse.
Well, it's a $7 trillion fall in equity. Now, just to put that into context, the dot-com crash wiped out $5 trillion. So now this is a bigger bubble burst than the dot-com bubble burst.
That's right, but... And, of course, this is a wider impact, however,
mm-hmm.
because more people will have been involved in the mortgage market. So mortgages, however, fell from just $11.95 trillion to $11.68 trillion. So that's barely a blip. You could barely
right.
count that as a decrease.
Right. And, of course, there's another huge many trillions of debts that are not even included because of the phantom or... The shadow banking system and the role that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the biggest supplier of mortgages, plays, and the fact that they keep many trillions of debts off the balance sheets and they don't even record them. So that number is quite a bit higher. Now, this phrase, deleveraging is a myth, I refer again to another Huffington Post blog that I posted about France.
Yeah.
And this is the way it goes, you see. And the UK is experiencing the same phenomenon. The government, to reduce debt, announces the sale of assets. Now, any buyer of those assets, of course, will use bank loans. But recently, the government has been buying all the banks. So whoever buys these assets will be borrowing from the government to buy the assets from the government. The price that they pay will be padded considerably by the banks who are enabling the transaction. And the net result will be that the loans will end up exactly where they started, except bigger, because you'll have to also pay off the bankers for the transaction fee.
Mm-hmm.
So net-net, you're not deleveraging at all. The more assets they sell, the greater in debt they're going to go.
Yes, and well, you can see on this chart, so house prices have fallen 34% in the U.S. since their peak, but mortgage balances have fallen only 2%. Remember those numbers. So property, the total value of property is now $13 trillion in the U.S. The total value of mortgages is nearly $12
trillion. Mm-hmm.
So there's only $1 trillion of equity in that $13 trillion of property.
Yes, and the interest expense on the mortgages continues, and folks are losing their jobs, and they can't get wage growth, and it's becoming a greater percentage of GDP. And so the interest cost on all the debt is now approaching, you know, that critical number of close to 90% of GDP, just the interest cost.
And then, Max, the final chart, the final bit of information on this story about why we need to write all these loans down so we can start, you know, get rid of the deflation faster,
mm-hmm.
is foreclosed homes on the market as of July 16th, 2010. And it looks at various cities in various states across the country, from Illinois to Florida to California, New Jersey, Ohio, Washington, Tennessee, Colorado, Missouri, and Arizona. And remarkably, less than 10% of repossessed homes are on the market, suggesting that the banks are hoarding all of these properties. They're not actually selling the homes, because mm-hmm. that would require them to mark down
yep.
the collateral on these loans. So they're just, it's the exact Japanese system of zombies. Zombie, in Japan, it was also many zombie corporations.
Mm-hmm.
But here you have a zombie housing market.
Yeah, they're sitting like zombies and dead zombies on balance sheets, and they are just festering and oozing liabilities, and there's another huge leg to the housing market coming, and all of this housing collapse and selling is continuing unabated, and I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, but you always mention this as like, you know, also hoarding all of those. So remember, less than 10% of the repossessed homes are even on the market. But that also gives them ammunition that as soon as, you know, most of those mortgages are held by the six big banks, ultimately, and they can whip those out for at strategic points to say, oh, you know, here we're going to crash the economy a little bit more.
Right, right. Yeah, well, of course, you have this, in other words, The Hank Paulson 2008 holdup of Congress, when he extorted $700 billion, that is primed in the pump and ready to go again. So anytime the banks, of course, who took the $15 trillion or so of new treasury bills that were issued by the government to try to keep the system liquid, anytime they want another $15 trillion, they're going to go in front of Congress and say, give us another $15 trillion or we're going to open the kimono and show you 15 to 20 trillion in debt that we haven't shown you before. Now, I know what I was going to say. Getting back to the Huffington Post story a little bit, we saw this in the UK, because remember when Cameron came into office, he said, we've got $800 billion in debt. We need to impose an austerity measure.
Yes.
And so they looked at the numbers more closely and they said, wait a minute, it's not 800 billion, it's 5 trillion pounds in debt.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 500% of GDP.
Yeah, so now we need to make, instead of 20% austerity, we need 40%.
Right. Now the question is it going to end at this $5 trillion number? And that's an open question. But getting back to what you were just saying a minute ago about writing down these debts, and the comment that the only way you can get any kind of economic growth is you've got to get rid of these debts first, right? That's the big point that's surfacing, is that, look, we have to we have to disclose these debts. We have to get rid of these debts, or otherwise we're just going to be sucked into a Japanese-style debt vortex. Now, there's only real... That's not going to happen. What is going to happen is they're going to have to devalue the dollar, number one. And number two, I've got some thoughts on the recent BIS gold swaps, which are kind of part and parcel to this. But the U.S. dollar and all these currencies will have to be reconfigured. Let's not say it's being devalued, because people take exception to that word, because they always say, well, devalued against what? Well, that's a fair point. But there will be a coordinated Plaza Accord type revaluation, Bretton Woods Part 2, global...
Part 3,
global reconfiguration of the currency grid. The U.S. dollar, world reserve currency, loses that status. It gets marked down 50% against other currencies, and they're going to have to restart everything that way. They'll do a massive write-off, but simultaneously reconstitute the global currency grid, and there'll be a massive winners and losers. It'll happen quite quickly, and there will be, you won't be able to prepare for it. Obviously, people who are buying gold and silver are going to do well. And on this front, the BIS gold swaps. Now, recently, I don't know if you saw this, you reported it, you talked about it on MaxKaiser.com. The Bank of International Settlements, the central bank, took from commercial banks gold in exchange for treasury paper.
Yeah.
In a deal that it's a repurchase agreement. The bank said, we're going to sell you this gold for paper, and we're also going to, it's a deal where we rebuy the gold at a future date.
That's correct. And the information, the FT yesterday came out with the actual names of the banks. At the time, everybody was thinking it was Portugal. But now it says that it was 10 banks, the Financial Times, according to Zero Hedge, and of which HSBC, Societe Generale, and BNP Paribas were the biggest.
Yes. Now, you see, this brings up exchange-traded funds.
Yeah.
Because exchange-traded funds like GLD and others in Europe, like Lyxor, are sponsored by banks. Banks are the counterparty. The gold that you buy effectively is unallocated gold. You don't have your name attached to that gold.
Mm.
Now, these banks ended up, you know, ETFs, the GLD, I believe, has 1,000 tons of gold. ETFs around the world have more than 1,000 tons of gold. They have a few thousand tons of gold. What these banks did was they've got that gold on their balance sheet, but it's not paying them any interest. They can't do anything with it. So that's where this BIS gold swap came from. They swapped their ETF holdings to the BIS for paper that they can get some interest on, with the deal being that they will then repurchase the gold at some future date. For example, if you needed your gold delivered to you, of course, that's not really possible as an ETF, but if that were the case, they would have to then get the gold that they sold you from the BIS, because that's that's who now holds your gold. You see? So this is where this gold came from. It's a function of all the gold that people have been buying in ETFs. Now, people buy gold ETFs in hopes that they can trigger a move out of a fiat currency paper world into a gold-backed currency world. But you see, what happens is that the Ponzi scheme is so high, so deep, so broad, that these commercial banks, through the central banks and the Bank of International Settlements, have many tricks up their sleeves. And here's yet another one. They needed another layer to the Ponzi scheme, because all this gold was mucking up their balance sheet, not paying them even 1.1% interest. So they swapped it to the BIS, and so they can keep their Ponzi scheme going and pay a little more interest on the money that, and get into that whole interest rate arbitrage cycle that they do with the central banks, just printing money for themselves that they keep, by the way. They don't loan out anymore, because they're just hoarding it to pay themselves bonuses until such time as they can use the debt side of the ledger to commit extortionary acts in Congress and extract a few hundred billion more.
Well, but let's look at this, because these are the big European banks. Now, the big European banks are also the hardest hit from the U.S. subprime mortgage meltdown in terms of banks being hit. So across Europe, you know, the population itself generally has, you know, very high savings rates, certainly compared to the U.S. And so they themselves are prudent, partly because, you know, try to go highly leveraged, try to, as a citizen of France, try to open a bank account with a job at McDonald's and get a, you know, $100,000 line of credit. It just can't happen. It won't happen. However, those French banks will take on the, you know, the derivatives backed by the same exact thing in America, thus exposing the citizens of France anyway to that same exact reality.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these French banks selling off or swapping this gold with the BIS. They were already hit hard by the U.S. subprime mortgage meltdown. And then, according to that article I was just reading, you know, the housing bubbles across Europe are far bigger and more deadly, potentially, than presumably, just because all bubbles crash.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably none of those debts, those mortgage debts, have been repackaged and sold to American investors. That's very unlikely to have happened. So presumably they're mostly on U.S. On European bank balance sheets.
That's right. And that's part, again, of this global reconfiguration of the currency markets. I believe, I'll make this forecast, that the euro over the dollar has hit the high for the year at 130 to the dollar. And we're going to see that trade at parity, one for one, as part of a global reconfiguration of the global currency grid.
Yeah, the one thing I must note, though, with that European house price bubble is there isn't an equivalent chart to explain how much of it is on with debt. So we see that the value of the U.S. housing market, for example, is $13 trillion, of which $12 trillion is debt. And, you know, it's something like half of Americans who own a home actually own it outright. So there you still see that still those mortgage debt, all those people are very much underwater. But in Europe, I haven't seen the numbers of how much of it is leverage.
So right. Those numbers show up on the analysis of the bank's balance sheets and the debt to equity ratios. So banks in Europe like BNP are trading at 50 times their reserves, and the banks in France and in Europe, some are trading at much higher multiples to reserves than anywhere else in the world. That's where the leverage shows up. And there's a beautiful phrase that people use to describe how banks are managing their funds. You know, they get their deposits, the retail deposits. That's one place to get reserves. And then they have what they call the wholesale reserve market. Wholesale reserves. Wholesale reserve market is a euphemism for engaging in global accounting fraud, where banks swap phantom tranches of imaginary collateralized obligations with each other for fees and claim, according to Basel 3 or 2, that this have some kind of reserve equity that they can use to leverage up their balance sheet, when none of it is worth anything and it's all collapsing into zero. And it's all happening at the same time as the global ecology is collapsing. So these two things are collapsing simultaneously. And it's been worked out beautifully in a report that you pointed out recently in Russia. Russia not only is experiencing a surprise attack of global warming and climate change that only a few years ago they thought they were welcoming, but now not only is their ecology on fire, but their bond market is collapsing because the bonds that are related to the agriculture sector won't be able to pay out any interest or dividends because there's no wheat. It's toast, unless they want to buy toasted wheat bonds.
That's a good one.
Toasted mini wheat bonds. You get 1 penny on the dollar, and it's shaped like a briquette of charcoal.
You mentioned Basel. I think I see the, they still haven't brought in the Basel III yet, but they've now agreed to relax the leverage rules that I don't know what they were proposed to be, but now they've settled on leverage of 33-1, which,
right.
The American banks were never even that leveraged, the big banks. I think Goldman Sachs was at 33 when it crashed.
Yeah, well, okay. All the banks in the world are connected. Chinese, India, America, Britain, Europe, Asia, Middle East. They're all connected to the central banks. They're all connected to the Bank of International Settlements. So Basel III saying that we can accept a 33-1 leverage ratio is like saying that planet Earth has 33 Earth orbs worth of ecological resources to pay off all this debt. They've sold forward planet Earth 33 times is the way to look at this. Now, planet Earth, since it's on fire and evaporating and becoming like the surface of Mars due to man-made global warming and climate change, the idea of getting 33 times the payout value of all the resources that for millions of years, nobody had to pay for their oxygen, their water, or their food. Nobody paid God their monthly God bill.
They got Zeus.
They got that all that stuff on the cuff. That's all free. Now, they're starting to have to pay for it. Water, food, food, if properly done, food is plenty of food for everybody. Water, food, air.
Not anymore. It's now, that's the biggest toll booth of all. That was the very first toll booth erected in the global matrix of
10,000 years ago.
Of the three things that need to be, that you need to sustain life. Well, and that's food. Well, no, Monsanto, Syngenta, all those people. But before we go on this, I want to make sure I said Goldman Sachs was at 33 times leverage before it crashed. I meant to say Lehman Brothers, but go ahead.
Yeah, the people think that economics is a study of scarcity, but it's not. Economics is a study of plentitude. The economics was started 10,000 years ago after the domestication of agriculture and animals, which created huge surpluses. It was only then that you needed a way to figure out how to manage your surplus. There was no need for economics during the hunter-gatherer phase of human development, which was a sustainable economic model that enjoyed fine and quality of life. I mean, the hunter-gatherers, many of them enjoyed very high qualities of life. We just saw an interesting film about the Brazilian rainforest. Apparently, just 1,000 years ago, it was dotted with unbelievable network of villages connected by these huge superhighways, basically. There was that they used to transport goods back and forth, and if one area was blighted, they could move into the village next door. So it was kind of like an internet, for rainforest-dwelling people. There was nothing, you couldn't take it down. Everything was connected.
Yeah, and, well, this is the new archaeological finds, because there were no giant marble or stone available, a lot of it, these villages and stuff were built with wood. And there was only one report, I think it was from the 1530s sort of area, of a Spanish priest in a this party of conquistadors that traveled down the Amazon accidentally. They didn't know that it was going to take them like 9 months. But he reported on seeing like masses amounts of people, like 5,000 people in one army and stuff. And everybody always dismissed this for hundreds of years as being impossible, that the Amazon couldn't possibly support that many people.
Right. Now, it was kind of one foot in both camps, both the hunter-gatherer and the domestication camp. I mean, there was it was kind of a transition economy and a transition civilization. So because the natural forces were still such that much of the time and energy was spent in trying to deal with living in the middle of a rainforest. But then you had both feet into fully domesticated economies. Going forward, where the natural part of the equation was subverted entirely by mechanization. Of course, certainly if you flash forward to the Industrial Revolution, then clearly you're in a new era when mechanization and specialization and liberal economics take effect. And you have a completely different economic model, which again is based on surplus, not shortages. And in that surplus, the value of the worker dropped to zero, basically. So then that was the beginning of the end of wages, or the beginning of wages and the end of livelihoods. And now it's interesting in America right now. I thought, you know, what's interesting is that, Stacey, I'm curious what you think about this. You know, we were saying, you point out that in countries like in the Middle East that are oil rich, natural resource rich, one of the reasons it's terrible for the people is because they're not needed to pay taxes. They're not needed to get work and pay taxes because the government is sitting on this huge annuity called an oil field. So they treat their people quite poorly, and human rights, there are no human rights. It's the curse of the oil, right?
Yeah, so they don't need the consent of the governed.
Right.
They don't need to grovel to get money. They already have it, and they don't need the population. The population is just a drain on their resources.
Yeah. Now, I see something similar in the United States, in that the United States government doesn't need people to get jobs and pay taxes, because they are sitting on the Federal Reserve printing press.
Yeah, they have the world's reserve currency. So I really think all of those taxes and the notion, you know, the whole IRS apparatus and stuff like that, that's just a fiction, I believe, to pretend that the U.S. dollar is backed by something. Because obviously they don't need to, they could just print because they are the world reserve currency.
Yeah, I mean, you hear so often now in the United States, people kind of throwing up their arms and asking why are things so bad, why don't we have any jobs, why is our ecology now becoming a wasteland? Well, the answer is, for more so than at any point in history, the people who run America don't need you. You're not needed.
That's been the case, and you could see it dramatically in the charts. The evidence is there in the data. Since 1971, since they went off the gold standard, they genuinely have no need for anybody to create wealth.
That's right. They're not even needed as a peasant. I mean, you know, going back to the medieval peasant-lord relationship, the peasants were vital to the success of the lord, and there was actually a bit of a symbiotic relationship there, and it wasn't all that as oppressive necessarily as people describe it. But in the U.S., or like in oil-rich countries, the population are simply not needed at all. They're not even at the level of peasants. They're just getting in the way. They're treated like vermin.
Well, you know what there is common between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, of course, is rising religious fundamentalism, because religion is the one thing that they're given.
Yeah, and I think more and more, you know, what happens is, you know, in American history, obviously, 150 years ago, 175 years ago, the settlers in America just didn't need the Indians anymore, did they? They killed them all off, they starved them, they shot all their buffalo, which effectively committed massive genocide by cutting them off from their food and shelter and life. Then the ones that survived, they put them on reservations. Now, in America, they're cutting people off from wages, cutting people off from jobs, cutting people off from the internet through draconian digital rights management technology, or through this vast Googleplex spying matrix. And those people, once they're popped off the grid, a lot of them are going to perish. The ones that don't perish will be just kind of put on these new cubicle casino gulag reservations.
That's right. Well, I mean, it would be one thing if you could just, you know, drop out, go off grid for real, and just, you know, grow your own food and start your own communities, or, you know, start your own alternative economy away from the neo-feudal one. But that's not an option. They don't allow it.
No, that's right. It's considered subversive, and people are busted for growing vegetable gardens and things like this, and the regulations are such where you can't have certain fertilizer at a certain day. You know, you might be constructing a massive fertilizer bomb or something, so you can't really buy more than a thimble full of fertilizer at a time. And
well, and the biggest reason, the biggest reason why you won't be able to drop off grid is because the banking industry, which owns the insurance industry, they are the same. Well, they've passed a law making it mandatory that every single American has to buy private health insurance. So therefore, if you just live on a, you know, your own land and cultivate fruits and vegetables and are self-sustaining, you still need to earn extra cash in order to buy this health insurance. So no matter what, you're not allowed to drop out.
That's right. And the story last week, which a lot of people were upset about, we've been talking about it for at least 3 years. The story now that I think it's Walmart is going to start putting RFID tags in the clothing they sell. Mm-hmm. So every pair of underwear, every t-shirt, every shirt, every pair of pants, every pair of shoes will have sewn in RFID tag, radio frequency identification tag, a barcode that's readable by a microwave or by satellite microwave, and you will be tracked in the database. And of course, the thing about technology over the past 25 years is that it falls down this asymptotic curve toward a cost of zero. So the database, the processing, the application, the manufacturing of all this stuff just keeps getting cheaper. It halves in price every 18 to 24 months. So the storage, you think, wow, who would want to, seems like an awfully expensive thing to store data on billions of items of clothing being bought. But if that information is stored on servers that have, that cost is dropping by 50% every 18 months, no, it doesn't cost anything. So you end up, again, part of this, it's impossible to, as you say, fall off the grid. You know, there's another myth, American myth, will go by the wayside. The frontiersman who's, you know, going out to west and to find themselves, you know, get lost and to find themselves. You know, I'm going to find myself. There, nobody will be needing to find themselves anymore because they can go online, punch in their name, and find out exactly where they are, who's watching them, of the 1,000 surveillance agencies that are watching you all the time.
Hey, you know, I was speaking to my mother this week, and she was explaining about my nephew. And I want to tell the story because it shows this, the banking insurance industry, how this has been, it's a command and control economy in the very same exact way that, you know, Americans allegedly fear about the socialism of Europe, where the U.S. isn't, it's not really socialism, it's more of a fascism because it's just a few select, you know, elite, I guess, that control all these corporations. But compared to when we were 16 or, you know, teenagers in America, I got my driver's license 3 days after my 16th birthday. And it was the very first time I ever drove was that morning. My driver's license appointment was like at noon. And I drove for the first time ever at 10 a.m., okay, in the Caldor's parking lot. Now, flash forward to, decades later, and my nephews, one is 17, one's 15. This is the process you now have to go through. And it's all because of insurance, lawsuits and stuff like that. So when you're 16, you can get a permit, which you have to have for 6 months. You have to take lessons in order to, you know, qualify for even taking your driver's license exam. And then once you get your driver's license, you're not allowed, this is in Connecticut, you're not allowed to have any passengers on your own that are not family. You're not allowed to carry them for 1 year after you get your driver's license. I guess because of lawsuits of too many teenagers getting in car accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So it just is like this giant apparatus that it builds up anyway. Like that, this seems to be something that Americans fear, all people fear, but we always then create it. We always create this giant monolithic, all-knowing, all-restricting machine.
Right. So the basically the bureaucracy is getting quite thick. And one of the complaints people have who move to Europe is the bureaucracy in countries like France or Germany is incredible. Just to get certain things done, you need to get 20 different papers signed and cross-signed and photos and wait in line. And people say, wow, in America, it's great. I could open a business in 5 minutes, get my driver's license, and I'm free. You know, but that's all being shut down. The frontier is being shut down. The new world is being foreclosed upon.
Well, it's just one, you know, the bureaucracy to get a driver's license in France, it's all state run. The same exact duplicate bureaucracy apparently runs in the U.S., but it's just privately owned insurance companies. There's like three of them who own everything, and so I guess you just make your choice of which one you want to have to taunt you.
Well, you see, that's a bad thing to have all these private contractors running all this data, because they use it to target you with ads and to fraudulently induce you to part with your money because they think they're part of this really fun casino where you can win valuable prizes. just by filling in this form and telling us what your favorite color is, we're going to give you a 5-credit bonus toward a cheese sandwich at 7-Eleven. And, you know, at the end of the day, basically, you become a data prostitute for cheese slices of Kraft processed cheddar cheese.
But they're all one and the same. We're told that there's differences between France and the U.S., for example. But like I was saying, take the metro in France.
All right.
Go to the post office. They're state run. However, there are no employees there anymore. Everything is run by computers. So there is no sort of privatization efficiencies that you can have. Everything is already gone. Pay your taxes here. Go, you know, file one single piece of paper with the French government. The next day you will be bombarded with brochures sent to your home from various cleaning companies and office supply companies. Where did they get your address from suddenly?
Mm-hmm.
Like literally a few days after you contact the French government. They do the same mm-hmm. thing. It's all a total racket. Everywhere you go is a casino gulag economy. It doesn't matter what they pretend like there are choices. Oh, you know, you don't want to be socialist like those people. You don't. But they're all. It's all a casino gulag.
Mm. Well, yes, it is becoming this way around the world for sure. And it's getting difficult to drop off the grid. Unless you live in Shoreditch, then you're just a bong pipe away from Nirvana. Who's playing in Shoreditch this very evening, Stacey? Who's headlining at the Shoreditch All-Night Bongathon Club?
The All-Night Bongathon Club? I think probably this show right here.
This is it, huh? Well, the price is right. You know.
Maybe somebody out there can create a ad for the Shoreditch All-Night Bongathon.
Yeah, go upstairs and demand from your mother a cookie.
There's a bigger and bigger demand, by the way, for legalization of marijuana in America. In fact, California would be the first one to totally, if all these laws pass that they're proposing, that growing of it would be also legal.
I'm working on a new beachwear fashion called Bong a Thong. You wear your bong like a thong.
Smokable thong.
It's a smokable thong made out of cannabis. You simply pull your pants off and roll them up and smoke them.
Well, that's a good one. I think it's a money.
Bongathong.net.
Well, somebody in Shoreditch could help us out.
Oh, heck yeah. Well, that's going to do it for this. Bye, y'all.